cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
China operates a system covering a population of more than 1.4 billion people with 56 different ethnic groups. What are the difficulties in its governance? And steeped in a continuous civilization spanning thousands of years, how does Chinese culture inform its modern political system? Welcome to part two of a special program on China, Democracy That Delivers. I would like to reintroduce our guests. They have been from New York, Dr. Robert Lawrence Kuhn, chairman of the Kuhn Foundation, joining us from Marseille, France, David Ferguson, honorary chief English editor of China Foreign Languages Press. Here in the studio, Xia Lu, research fellow of the National Academy of Development and Strategies of Renmin University of China, and Miao Xiaojuan, journalist with China's official Xinhua news agency. Once again, warm welcome to all of my guests. But first, let's take a look at a brief intro to the history and structure of China's political system. A persistent debate revolves around whether China is a democracy or not. Critics often lament the fact that key policies seem to be orchestrated behind closed doors by party elites. China's democracy actually features aspects that are representative and electoral. It's referred to as whole process people's democracy, or democracy with Chinese characteristics. However, to grasp the essence of democracy in China, it is imperative to delve into its historical roots and understand its rationale. Following the revolution of 1911, there were multiple attempts by China to adopt Western political systems such as parliamentary, multi-party, or presidential systems, all of which failed. On October 1, 1949, the People's Republic of China was founded, marking the transformation from a millennia-long feudal autocracy to a people's democracy. For the first time in history, the Chinese people became masters of the country. In 1954, the first constitution of New China was adopted at the first National People's Congress, or NPC. The People's Congress system was established. How does it work? The NPC is the highest organ of state power. It creates all administrative, supervisory, judicial, and procuratorial organs of the state. Deputies to People's Congresses are elected every 5 years. Those at township and county levels are directly elected by the public, while deputies to the higher levels are elected from among candidates at the next lower level. In 2023, there were altogether about 2.8 million deputies to People's Congresses at all levels. 95% of them were directly elected by voters. And there are a total of over 1 billion voters in China. Other forms of elections also take place. For instance, rural and urban residents elect members to community committees to manage their own affairs. By 2020, all villages and urban communities in China had elected such committees, numbering over 600,000 in total. As to political parties, China has 9 political parties, including the ruling party, the CPC, and 8 non-communist parties. In China, political parties don't compete for the power to govern, which ensures continuity of policies. The 8 non-communist parties work together with and under the leadership of the CPC in order to create synergy in exercising state power. Members of these parties and those without party affiliation account for a certain percentage of legislators at all levels, some occupying leading posts in state organs. Every year, thousands of top legislators and political advisors meet in Beijing to submit motions and proposals on how to improve governance. From 2018 to 2023, the central government adopted a total of 18,000 suggestions and proposals tabled by national lawmakers and political advisors, 40% of which became policy measures. In a nutshell, China's democracy is born out of its traditional wisdom and tested by time. It is the choice of the Chinese people. It may be new for some, but has worked wonders for China and continues to deliver. Let's continue our discussion about Chinese democracy. Let me go to Mr. Xia here. Some people would say, well, China achieved a tremendous amount of development, but if the Chinese system is not democratic, how could it have achieved such development?
Thanks for the question. In order to answer this question, I would like to bring two important books written by American scholars dealing with the function of democracy or whether there are function of democracy. The first one is written by Professor Lili Tsai, who used to be a MIT professor. Now she's moving to the Hong Kong UST, University of Technology and Science. And doctoral dissertation became a book titled "The Accountability Without Democracy." And she studied the township and the village level Chinese official or Chinese cadres kind of accountability in dealing with the, you know, drainage, in dealing with the poverty, in dealing with those kind of the rural development thing. And her argument is that although there are no standardized democratic procedure in China's rural area, according to those Western scholars, there are accountability, because this accountability or the driving force of this rural level official to do this kind of thing, to solve all this kind of problem, is not from they would be voted out for next term, is because they have their kind of commitment or, let's say, a devotion to the local, you know, development. This is not about democracy or not. This is not about democratic procedure. So her argument, Professor Lili Tsai's argument, is that although there is no so-called standardized Western democracy or democratic procedure, there are still accountability and there are still this kind of function of this system. On the other hand, Professor Francis Fukuyama, who is very famous, actually almost 30 years ago, he published a book called End of the History and The Last Man, something like that. He argued that after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the former communist region, there would be no challenge in political system towards the liberal democratic system in the U.S. And he argued that, when all the countries in this world adopted and established those kind of liberal democratic system, there would be no history, because there would be no variant in humans kind of civilization. Well, after one decade, when he also studied Iraq and Afghanistan after this kind of two wars, he changed his idea, since that he thought that the state building, state capacity, it's much more important, it's much more significant than to just borrow or copy other country standard, model to a kind of developing country. Mm-hmm. So the most important thing is not to change the form, but to solve the real problem. And in my opinion, just to get back to your question, China's political system, China's whole process, people's democracy, actually tackled this essence of China's problem in terms of development. And that is the pragmatic orientation.
Right? Yeah, the pragmatism. Okay, you mentioned that. David, just now Dr. Kuhn was talking about let's not mix development and democracy, and he didn't agree with your proposition of sort of a black and white, approach to the problems in the Western style democracy and the gains in the Chinese style democracy. Do you have some reaction? What is your reaction? I mean, again, I'm fascinated with the question, if China's system is not a democratic one, how could it achieve such tremendous development? I honestly, would like to wonder that.
Well, let me respond to that. At the end of the day, democracy is just a label. All it is it's a label that people put on things. And then you can have a great argument about, we're more democratic than them. They're not democratic. Are they democratic? Are they not democratic? There's a simple question to answer in all of this. Does this country have good governance? Does the governance of this country deliver good outcomes? And if the answer to this question is yes, this country has good governance, and yes, this country's governance delivers good outcomes, it doesn't really matter what label you apply to it. And if you ask these questions about China's democracy, whatever you call it, if you ask this question about China's governance, it delivers good outcomes. And if you subject so-called Western democratic countries to that very simple question, do you have good governance and does your governance deliver good outcomes? You end up with a very, very different answer.
One persistent debate revolves around that whether China is a true democracy or not. Critics often lament that key policies were made not based on the feedback from the masses, but rather made by a small group of people or even one person. Xiaojuan, let me come back to you. What exactly is the Chinese decision-making process seen from the mayor level? And is that representative of the whole chain of decision-making process in China, meaning from the grassroots to the very top?
Yes, I think like at different levels, they might be slightly different in terms of details, but the philosophy or the structure behind it is very consistent. So speaking from the mayor's level, which is what I have observed with my own eyes, I think probably I can give a few examples to explain how decisions are made for the local governments and for different cities. For example, in Zhangzhou City, Fujian province in southern China, they have lots of tulou, or the traditional earthen buildings. The government wants to revitalize or restore those buildings to protect the cultural heritages and also to improve the local economies. There were lots of disagreements. The residents living in those buildings, they had lots of opinions, they were against it and they have concerns. So what the government did was to request a representative from each household. And for about 100 days, more than 3 months, they sit together and they work out a plan. They find a consensus that everyone agrees, or the majority would agree. And then they also invite the best experts in industry to help design and to make a long-term plan. And they didn't go for a full implementation at the beginning. They tried in a smaller area to have some pilot projects. Mm-hmm. And when the other residents see that, oh, these smaller projects are working, so they'd like to follow. And now it's a massive success. And I think that decision-making process is both democratic and effective. And it not only helped preserve the cultural heritages, but also boosted rural tourism and increased the incomes of the villagers. And the other decision-making process example, I think it has to come from within the government.
Yeah.
When you sit by and watch how they have meetings, one thing that impressed me the most was how they always have the highest level official, in our case is the mayor. The mayor always speaks the last.
What is the role of the party secretary, for instance, after, you know, because you're talking about the mayor, they are different. How does the consultation results of the, you know, the administrative branch is approved or disapproved by the party secretary? How does that work?
From the mayor part, it's mostly administrative. And to the best of my knowledge, once they make a decision, they would have to go through the higher level of discussion. And after that, it has to be approved by the local people's congress. Yeah. So it's voted by the lawmakers.
Mm. Yeah. Dr. Kuhn, I see you seem to have a lot of thoughts to share. What was on top of your mind when you hear the differences between the Chinese decision-making and the Western decision-making? Are the observations correct according to you? Because you also travel extensively in China.
Yeah, and I would begin with the how the system works in China, which I followed during the poverty alleviation campaign. And what I actually spent time with was five levels of party secretaries at the provincial, municipal, county, township, and village level. So there are five levels. I worked with the party secretary in one particular, in each case, and saw what the division of labor was, what the responsibilities were, who had what responsibility. And I had one, which to me was a very poignant example. I was having lunch with the party secretary at the county level, and in the anti-poverty campaign, and in many things, the implementation of these projects have a center point at the county level in China, which can be a million, 2 million people, but it's a county level. And I was with the party secretary, and he asked me what I was doing. And I said, the day before, I was in a village, and I met the local party secretary, a young man, maybe late 20s, early 30s, who was spending a year or two away from his family. He visited a couple of times a month, but he was working with 150 or 200 families in that area. And I was very impressed. I rode with him on his motorcycle. And what impressed me even more was the party secretary. As soon as I told him my little story, he called over his assistant. He said, cancel my meetings tomorrow. I'm going out to meet that party secretary in that county. I want to understand what he's doing that so impressed Dr. Kuhn. And that to me was really impressive. And the thing about China, and what David said before is absolutely right, that competence in governance is very critical. And the training of officials in China is at a very high level. Now, it's not perfect because nothing is perfect with human beings. And the issue that China deals with the benefits of top-down leadership, and they're very clear what those are. But the counter to that is what happens when it doesn't work, when there's something that goes awry, because there's no institutionalized system for correcting that. And so that's the tension. That deals with the party's anti-corruption campaign, the national commissions to investigate. And, you know, so China has its own way of dealing with these things. But, you know, we really have to, in today's world, deeply understand how each culture works in its own way, and then be very careful about trying to transmit that to other kinds of cultures. Because each one has its own problems and areas, and why China has worked so well developmentally has to do with a lot of factors that don't necessarily only deal with a certain kind of political system.
Of course.
Because we see examples of that in other countries which have not worked at all.
Yeah. David, let me go to you here, and it's, again, another fascinating question for me, because you have been working on President Xi Jinping's thoughts on governance. You edited, basically you read through and edited the English versions of all of his major speeches, presentations, you know, you had a thorough scanning and understanding of President Xi's thoughts. And one thing that struck a lot of people is that he quotes extensively from traditional Chinese literature, from traditional Chinese texts. And there is a re-emphasis of combining China's political system, or recognition of the cultural roots of China's modern political system, which is steeped in China's long-term culture and civilization. What makes China different in terms of culture from other societies which inform its political system today?
The most important facet of that, Liuxin, is that China's culture genuinely goes back thousands of years. And if I was to take one specific example, there is something called He culture, which is about harmony and diversity. And that has been a very important theme in Chinese culture for a very, very long time. China seeks harmony. It seeks to build the consensus that Robert was talking about. It seeks to build agreement, at the same time recognizing diversity of ideas, recognizing diversity of opinion. And if you can succeed in bringing these two factors together in a positive way, then you will gain from the diversity, and you will create a consensus about this is what we want to do, and this is how we want to move forward. And I think that it's a really important aspect of President Xi's governance that he places such emphasis on this. He looks back into ancient Chinese culture, he looks for inspiration, he finds ideas, and he tries to make them meaningful to modern China and to show how these can become important drivers of China's modern governance.
Xiaojun here. Do you agree with that analysis, the philosophical or cultural difference behind China's choice of its political system and the Western choice? And one criticism is the lack of transparency. You know, a lot of things are done behind doors, consultations done behind doors, and people think that, you know, that is not democratic. If you don't show it to the world, if you're not transparent, we don't know how the decision is made, so there may be elements of corruption. What is your understanding?
China invented the examination system for selecting government officials. So the modern democratic system, I think it inherits traditional political wisdom and then adapts it to the contemporary situation. Just a little bit back to what David said earlier. So I think that's why China's democratic system has its own strength. It comes a long way back to the ancient times.
Why is the Western voting system not compatible to the Chinese emphasis on harmony? We don't like to quarrel in public.
I think the Chinese system, it breaks some of the invisible thresholds of wealth, background, so it's based on virtue, competence. So if you're competent enough, you will stand out. And that's how you realize on the competent people.
But people will say you can do that in public too. I mean, can't you have, you know, there are also competition where people demonstrate their competence in public. Can't that be done here? Is that being done? Yeah?
Yes, please allow me to just jump in. I'm sorry. First of all, yes, voting could solve some kind of a disagreement, but it should be within a homogeneous kind of situation. If a society, well, has a lot of cleavages, for example, societal cleavage, regional cleavage, and different cultural cleavages, and voting might not be solving the problem at one stance. Voting, this kind of thing, might expand or might, let's say, reinforce or even, you know, get worsened this kind of social cleavage situation, like what I have seen in a lot of countries, like what I have seen in a lot of kind of newly independent, the former colonists in Africa. African countries. Like, so it's not about the voting. We always say that, okay, voting, you know, costs a lot of, you know, no, it's not about voting. Voting is just one procedure. We couldn't blame everything to voting. We should combine the whole situation together to think about what is the problem. So in my opinion, for developing countries, let's get back to the first question, what is the most important thing or what are the priorities for developing countries? The first thing is national unity. Is the solidarity for one premature society. If one country or if one society, well, it's just newly established, and there are a lot of issues to be solved in terms of to consolidate the social, let's say, solidarity, in consolidate the identity, well, voting might not be the effective way to solve the problem. On the other hand, or otherwise, it might, you know, worsen the situation. Mm. So let's just put it, voting is the way to solve problem, but we should consider the time and the location.
It's part of
right.
A good
yes.
governance right. system,
right.
maybe not
right.
runs everything.
You see, can I step in there? You asked the question, why shouldn't voting work well in China? It does work well in China. In China, a lot of Western people don't understand that at the grassroots level, there are direct elections
right.
for the governors, the people who actually run the system, the people's congresses. They are directly elected up to the county level or the district level. And it works really well. Why does it work really well? Because it's on a human level. It's on a human scale where you know the people that you are voting for. And it does work. It works in China.
Mm. I was mentioning about this direct voting for the leader of the country, like the one practiced in some country, but not in the United States, which is also a misperception here. I'm running out of time, but we have one last segment where I would ask you and ask Xiaoxing to come out again to address questions raised to us by people from the internet. And the first one actually is very much related to what we just talked about. If the Chinese system is so effective, why does it only work in China and why do other developing nations not adopt it? Who would like to take up that question?
I would like to question the fundamental logic of this question. Why would other country adopt China's political system? Why would other country adopt China's model of political system in solving China's problem? Well, different country should pursue their own, let's say, you know, forms of political system to solve their own problem, right? Mm. So, you know, the fundament or the fundamental, you know, the logic of this question, well, maybe we should rethink about the fundamental. Maybe we have already been, let's say, influenced by, you know, typical or standardized understanding about it. You know, if that country is doing well, we should learn from that country. If that country is doing good, we should copy that country's, you know, kind of a model of the political system. We should, you know, learn the experience. We should learn the good kind of lessons.
Emulate.
But, yeah, yeah. But we shouldn't just copy, simply copy that country's political system.
Hmm. I put the last question to Xiaoxing. Let's not forget her. Basically, I put the last question to ChatGPT and asked Xiaoxing now to appear again and present the answers to us. So, Xiaoxing, time to wake up. Welcome back. Yuxin, I'm still here. I almost fell asleep. But tell me, what's the question from the overseas user? Thank you for your patience. So the question is, why is the Chinese government so much more effective than any other government? Again, it's a question from an online user.
The effectiveness of the Chinese government compared to others stems from several factors. One key element is its ability to implement long-term plans and policies efficiently, often leveraging its centralized decision-making structure. Additionally, China's emphasis on pragmatism and adaptability allows it to respond swiftly to changing circumstances, fostering stability and growth. Moreover, the government's focus on development and improving living standards has garnered support from its populace, contributing to its effectiveness in delivering tangible results overall. The combination of strategic planning, adaptability, and a focus on development has played a crucial role in making the Chinese government more effective than others in certain contexts.
Thank you so much. It's been such an interesting discussion. Many thanks once again to all my guests, Dr. Robert Lawrence Kuhn joining us from New York, chairman of the Kuhn Foundation, David Ferguson joining us from Marseille, France, who is honorary chief English editor of China's Foreign Languages Press, Xia Lu, research fellow of the National Academy of Development and Strategies from Renmin University of China, and Miao Xiaojuan, journalist from China's official Xinhua News Agency. Thank you very much.